the internship is about, I feel at heart, to learn about our culture. We're able to go out there and learn about it through the land and being on the land.
I think we've benefited because of that intertribal perspective, you know? It's their cultural heritage. So what better way to protect heritage at a broad scale, but also understand it, to actually have the people who own the heritage as part of the process from the very beginning to the very end?
One of the things I think about a lot is how much things like tribal-led archaeology, tribal-led survey and stewardship, how important these things are going to be in the coming decades, in the coming generations.
Welcome to Challenging Colonialism, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of Indigenous California. An important note from the start, the producers are two white male educator academics, and these are not our stories. This podcast centers Native voices, and our intention is to highlight the significant work being done by Indigenous communities to challenge ongoing colonialism and to broadcast information about the resistance and resilience of Indigenous California in the past, present, and the future.
Last season, we had a series of episodes exploring the extractive and exploitative legacies of the academic fields of anthropology and archaeology. In this episode, we highlight a different model, sharing an example of collaborative archaeology performed by and for the benefit of Native peoples. This episode was recorded in the fall of 2025 as the speakers discussed their participation in the summer archaeology internship coordinated by the Amamutsin Tribal Band.
My name is Gabriel Pineda. I'm an Amamutsin Tribal member. I'm also a Native steward. We do plant propagation program. There's various programs, ocean program. We do cultural burn program. And we also do land restoration. And also archaeology, cultural resources. When I first started with the tribe in 2009 in the Pinnacles, we just started off with just like archaeology. And then during the years going up to 2014-15, we were just going off like ethnobotany hikes, just going to different places and like IDing the plants and seeing how much abundance of plants there is, like hazelnuts or like red maids, and like kind of like noting those and like putting them in kind of like a database. We started the stewardship corps back in 2014 or 15, I believe. And we started off where the Costa Nova easement's at for 3 weeks. We were with Rob Cutthroat, couple cousins, Josh Aguirre, Abraham Lopez, Paul Lopez, and my cousin Nathan Vasquez. We're the original stewards at first, right there at the Costa Nova Lodge easement, where we did 3 weeks of jabata grass using Pulaskis to take them out. It was very strenuous work. So that was my first taste of land restoration right there. Growing up, my grandfather kept it from us that we're Native because back in, well, he was born in the 30s and he was from Madera. So my family's from Madera, California, Fresno area. Back then they had to say that they're Mexican in order to survive because it was very racial there. And I heard stuff, you know, stories from my aunt that we were Native American, but I really didn't believe that. Or I couldn't, you mean, I was just a kid, so I didn't really process it in my head. And actually, third or fourth grade, I went to the San Juan Bautista Mission, also did a little project. They told us all about how they taught the natives how to grow crops, and they took care of the natives, and, you know, said something totally different to me. And then when I was about 17, my grandfather passed away. I guess we got a call where I guess everybody had to get their paperwork done to enroll in the tribe. So like a lot of our family, we started enrolling, and I was like, oh, wow, well, I guess we are Native American. Then I started like meeting people like natives in Fresno doing like intertribal stuff. I had a little rough road in my life. I went to these rehab facilities that were Native American, and that's how I started getting into learning more about Native American culture, starting to go to SWET, singing songs, like kind of like intertribal songs, because I didn't know my songs. So that's how I started learning, and then started going to, we started having events, picnics, you know, with the Amamusin tribe, and you know, that's how I started getting involved. And 2009 is when I went to the Pinnacles and got involved with the archaeology with Berkeley, and there are some of us cousins there, you know, working with alongside with Berkeley.
My name's Gabe Sanchez. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Oregon in the Department of Anthropology, and I also teach in Native American Indigenous Studies. I'm what some would say is a traditionally trained archaeologist, right? I'm not Native Californian. You know, my family's from Mexico, but I was trained, you know, in like a traditional Western academic kind of archaeological tradition. But at the same time, while I was receiving my training here in kind of traditional archaeological methods, I was mentored and trained by Native groups in how to do archaeology kind of through their lens, right? So one thing that's been really formative for me is I was actually mentored by the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde here in Oregon. And I could, as an undergraduate, had opportunities to kind of sit in like consultation meetings between like tribes and state federal agencies and like other archaeologists. So I think that experience has been really informative for me as like a academic researcher, scientist, and seeing the ways that I kind of say it this way, but how archaeology can be leveraged by tribes and cultural heritage management. And I think that's really been super informative in the ways that I conduct research with and for Native Californian tribes and other communities here in the U.S. Really, there's a long legacy from Amamutsin Land Trust working in archaeological field schools, going back to the work at, you know, Ano Nuevo Quiroste Valley, right? In what, 2007, 2008. So we had a discussion with tribal chairman Valentin Lopez and Alec Apodaca about trying to integrate the two programs and have it as like a, you know, a formal course for university students, and then having kind of that formal structure be part of the summer internship program as well, with a focus on archaeology as one component of, you know, stewarding lands and cultural heritage, but also focusing on culture as well, and having, you know, university students understand indigenous perspectives in cultural heritage management, archaeology, and other components. And bringing those two separate programs together would be mutually beneficial for everyone involved.
Mishmin Truhis, Kanrika Elizabeth, good day. My name is Elizabeth. I'm an Amamutsun tribal member. I'm currently at Fresno City College. I'm as a transfer student, so hopefully next year I'll be looking into transferring. I'm part of the RAIN program, Resources for American Indian Needs, and I'm currently majoring in anthropology. So when I was 15, I joined, and then COVID happened. And then so I think there was one time there was an internship that year, but I wasn't able to go. And then it closed down, and then I was able to rejoin because it reopened in 2023. And I've been there ever since. But it has been very different, because since the reopening and kind of trying to get our stewards back, 2023 was without our stewards. So that was a little bit of a change that I noticed, because I was used to having even more people around, because during the first internship, there were so many of us. There was probably like 20 of us, just interns alone probably. And then we had all our stewards. And I think that was the first time where I really got to know what being around community and family and what that felt like. So that's what really drew me back in 2023, was to go back and do that and have those feelings again. In 2023, without the stewards, it was a little different. It was more so focused on working with state parks. So that was a major difference, and it was a smaller group of us, but it was still very nice, because that's when we just got the Bonnie Doon House. That was like a kind of our first times there. I met more cousins too. I mean, I knew them when I was younger, but then we like grew apart and they moved away. So I was able to see him again. So it was like reconnecting again, which was very nice. And then, yeah, and then these past 2 years, it's been collaborative with Gabe Sanchez in the field school.
Technically, there's really like two programs at play here, right? So there's the Amamutsen Land Trust, Amamutsen Tribal Band, like summer internship program, which is really designed to bring tribal youth for this community living in diaspora, right? There's community members who come in from Kansas and Ohio, different portions of California, Las Vegas, et cetera, right? They're all coming back into their ancestral homelands, really to be together, I think is first and foremost, right? To be in community with their loved ones. And second of that is, you know, providing some type of training opportunity, right? So there's some summer employment, but really capacity building and just seeing other types of opportunities available to tribal members as they continue in their college careers or whatever that could be, right?
Well, my name is Alec Apodaca, and I'm currently the Cultural Resources Program Manager for the Amamutsen Land Trust. And I came into that position through my PhD research at UC Berkeley. And my dissertation, which I am in the final throes of and wrapping up, fingers crossed, this is my last semester. Every summer, the Amamutsen Land Trust has a 5-week or a 6-week project where they bring teenagers and also young adult tribe members. We bring them out into the field and in the lab to get exposed to a little bit more of what the land trust is doing. And it might be beneficial to say that within the Amamutsen Land Trust, the Cultural Resource Program has various goals and projects. And one of them is Native archaeological monitoring. Another one is consultation, you know, dealing with NAGPRA, Assembly Bill 52, mitigating sensitive sites and projects on sensitive sites. It's also research, and then there's education. But within these programs, there is a need for tribe members to be in these leadership roles to go and do this work. You know, there is a need for Native archaeological monitors that are trained not only in their culture, but also trained in archaeological method in theory. They are sort of the eyes of the tribe. They're out there every day on construction projects, developments, and in some regards, they are the last line of defense that tribes have to protect sensitive sites, ancestral remains, that sort of thing. And so we're taking a look at our program and know that, oh man, we need people. We need really good people that can come in and carry this forward, right?
Yeah, the summer intern program. Yeah, I'm very involved with that. I was like they called me the senior steward, like a lead steward, and I'm kind of like there to kind of guide the kids and be a mentor and kind of like teach them, like how to be there. I mean, just be there and like kind of help them out with the paperwork or do screening, just helping out with the day-to-day tasks and doing the surface units and, you know, how to identify the different shellfish and, you know, cherts and, you know, different lithics. And, you know, for me becoming, I mean, not going to college or anything, you know, I think I know pretty much. I think I'm doing pretty well.
My name is Cameron V.C. Garcia. I myself am a member of the Chelon Indian Council of Bakersfield. I'm about 23, gonna be going on 24 here pretty soon. And I'm a recent graduate of Fresno State University. I got my bachelor's in anthropology with an emphasis in archaeology and my minor in American Indian Studies. I believe that anthropology and archaeology, there is a calling for Native people to participate in it. Mostly because here in North America, at the very least, a majority of the pre-contact archaeology, well, actually, no, not even a majority, but all of pre-contact archaeology here, unlike in like Europe and other countries where the ancestors they're digging up are very, very far and disconnected in a sense. And, you know, there's not necessarily a feeling of direct lineage between the remains of, you know, ancient Vikings or other folks like that in, say, Europe and those excavations. Here in North America and Central and South America as well, there is that direct lineage. There is that direct connection and feeling between us as modern Native people and then our ancestors. You know, we don't separate ourselves as seeing the ancestors being far, far removed from us, like being ancient ones who, you know, we just give our permission willy-nilly to excavate their things. No, we don't. We see them as still being part of us. And as well, this archaeology isn't being conducted, and never was. It wasn't being conducted on the basis of what we thought was appropriate. It was always an imperialist archaeology. It was always extractive, always exploitative.
We need really good people that can come in and carry this forward, right? And so we see the summer intern program as just one of these ways where we can start building that experience. We can start building the confidence in some tribe members and give them that opportunity to get basically university level training in archaeology and also in their culture, tribal history, all those sorts of things. And we just see it as one of these great methods to retain folks, but also to really build them up so that they can be protectors of their own cultural heritage, you know?
I see the work actually, like, it goes home with them. And the reason why I say that is because the next week, like after the internship, we were able to come together again and we went to Point Lobos. And we were just out there, and my cousins, my younger ones, they were pointing out, oh, that shirt, that's a shell. I know that plant. Because we're not just learning about the shirt, we're learning about plants too. And they're able to point it out. They're able to learn it. And they're pointing out things I didn't see either. They're like, oh, this is this. They're like, where's my SSU kit? They're ready to do SSUs. but seeing their excitement in their eyes to learn, and because also they're able to see it not just at the work, they're able to see it at just like a regular park. And I think that's really important, because when they go out and maybe want to do other hikes, they can understand what those plants mean and why they were there.
You know, teaching the students, like, okay, the paperwork and, you know, how to screen and stuff like that. You know, they're there to teach me also, the students, like, with their learning in school. And then I'm there to teach them the hands-on, actually, you know. That's how I learned, being hands-on and not in the classroom. And, you know, the internship is very special, you know, because we have about 8 to 10, 10 of our youth, you know, from ranging from 16 to like college students up to probably like 30. And yeah, it gives them an opportunity, because this might be their first, like, their summer job, and they're out here for 4 to 5 weeks, and this gives them experience in Native archaeology and to learn what we're doing out here, and that we're doing it in a good way with low intensity. We're not like messing with the ground impact or anything and stuff like that. We're just trying to teach them, these kids, a good way about archaeology and to learn about their culture also.
As educators, we have this responsibility to prepare the students to enter this field. Either they're going to be academics themselves, but most likely they're going to be working for state parks, they're going to be working for national parks, they're going to be working for cultural resource firms, you know? And so, like, how do we get them ready to be archaeologists in this new era, right? And as we know that this new era, there is, it's extremely challenging for universities to do archaeological research in California. Rightly so, right? Rightly so. I think that archaeologists need to get their ducks in a line. There's a lot of stuff that you know, we all need to work on, and to, I guess, to be very literal, the skeletons in the closet, right, that are in the basement of museums and all that. But I think that this kind of tribal-led approach to a field school is one of the best ways that we can do it. It's where we are bringing students who probably are learning, you know, indigenous studies in the classroom, and, you know, they're learning all these things. And then we kind of put them in a field setting where they're sharing meals with Amamutsin tribe members, they're camping with Amamutsin tribe members, they're learning about the tribal history from tribal elders and from people, you know, from the community. And then they're like doing this flavor of archaeology that is a little bit different than probably that they were taught or some of the methods that they probably read about in a textbook, you know. I just see it as like one of these, it's one of many great ways that we can still educate students in how to be archaeologists in California in our new era.
A lot of my work while I was at Fresno State had to do with things such as CalNAGPRA, the evolving relationship between archaeologists and natives, and basically, where's the field going to go? Because with the during my junior year was when AB 389 got passed, and that basically affected the whole trajectory of my academic career going forward. Because although I was training to be a tribal archaeologist, on the side of the CSUs, which, Fresno State is a CSU, that really shook things up. And I very quickly went from working in a lab with a bunch of partially organized collections and unknown, things within those collections to working for like a ethnobotany plant research project to eventually being hired on to work a very short stint doing CalNAGPRA. As a part of like the introductory CalNAGPRA department that was required of all the CSUs. Every single CSU had to get a CalNAGPRA department, had to get a CalNAGPRA coordinator, had to get it all ironed out, everything inventoried. And that was like happening during almost the senior year of my educational career. Yes, I'm an anthropologist, but more importantly, I'm a tribal archaeologist and I'm a tribal person. My background, I always say is that I'm Chulone. And people, they don't really know what Chulone is. For those who don't know, Chulone is one of the eight Ohlone Coast Minoan language families. And my family and my tribe are very, very not well documented. The majority of us were brought to either Mission Soledad, and I believe there were some who were brought to Mission San Juan Bautista. For my tribal lineage, my fifth great grandfather, Iguina, later named Pedro, he was brought from Rancheria del Tatlon, and he was converted with his wife. He was the 19th baptism. His wife Juana, her original name was, excuse my pronunciation, Lebohuchan. She came from the Esalen village of Macalachopos, and she was the 20th baptism of Mission Soledad. My tribal background and my family, somehow we were one of the few Chulon lineages which made it out of Mission Soledad and was able to reconnect and find our identity as that, which includes like trying to bring back our ceremony, trying to learn about Ohlone and Esalen culture, revive our language, which is something I've been very heavily involved with. That's my mother's family, that's all of their lineage as well. I always admit. I always say, because I have no shame in it whatsoever. I'm also Mexicano, Chicano, and I'm also Chinese, and obviously like Southern European, because my family lineage is still California. That's all the various parts of me. There's a reason why my second last name is Chow. The C in DC stands for Chow. But that's who I am. Just another young native guy is trying to make my way through this world. And I am a combined identity, just trying to do right by my family and my friends and kin.
You know, some of the research questions that I was asking was how were indigenous people utilizing and stewarding natural resources in the Santa Cruz Mountains? And this was building on the shoulders of a lot of other academic research, archaeological research that was happening. I was mostly focusing on the lowlands. So my job was to come in and look at some of the highland sites, some of these montane sites, and really take a paleoethnobotanical approach. To look at the plant remains in these sites here. So, yeah, there were some fascinating findings from that study, but I think the big part was that I was thrown into this collaborative project And I didn't really know any different, right? Because this was the flavor of my lab at UC Berkeley, the Kent Lightfoot California Archaeology Lab. I didn't really know any different. I thought that was just kind of the way that it was done. And what I mean by that, it's, you know, research questions were drawn up under the leadership of tribal council and tribe members from the Yamamutsin tribal band. The participation in the field and in the lab was really greatly represented from tribe members as well. And so it was multiple phases of the research was really driven by the goals of the Yamamutsin tribal band and the Yamamutsin Land Trust. A really big project in Santa Cruz and San Benito and Santa Clara County is to better understand that long-term legacy that indigenous people had with stewarding ecosystems and stewarding the environment, such as cultural burning, such as, you know, shellfish harvesting regimes, things of that nature. We really wanted to just get a better handle of those seasonal movements of people, but also to understand a little bit better of those legacies of stewardship. So that's just a little bit about my background and then kind of also how I landed at the Yamamutsin Land Trust. And I guess I should say here that when I say we, I mean we as a staff member of the Yamamutsin Land Trust, which is comprised of tribe members and also non-tribe members. And I am not a Yamamutsin tribe member myself. I'm just a Mexican-American guy from San Diego that somehow landed in Santa Cruz doing some really cool research.
Yeah, I think it's really important for students specifically, kind of a different lens, right? Because in my experience, it can be really challenging for students to understand why they need to be in conversation with tribes and communities. And I've had students open up and say that, like, well, you know, I create my research question, I have my hypothesis, and, you know, I am an objective scientist. And, you know, having other perspectives could kind of maybe affect my interpretations and my good research practices. And I've had to kind of really work hard to reposition students kind of baseline to understand that, like, you don't work in a vacuum, right? When you're doing archaeological work in X, Y, and Z location, you're building on a legacy of colonialism in that space. Even having this like inherent belief that you have some form of right to indigenous cultural heritage without having a conversation is problematic, and it's being built off of, you know, generations of archaeologists who have kind of contributed to this legacy. And through courses, like I teach a class on decolonizing archaeology, which is really archaeological ethics and showing students, you know, other pathways of doing research through co-developing research questions and other, you know, things we can do to kind of mitigate these problems. I do think it's really critical to kind of show this other pathway in doing research. For example, we know, like myself, I went to school at UC Berkeley, right? There is a legacy at UC Berkeley for kind of a very extractionist type of mentality in doing research. And I think helping this new generation of students recognize some of those problematic practices in the past and finding kind of another pathway or solution to kind of not replicate those problems that have already occurred, right? And historically, that's what makes kind of these types of research projects, collaborative research, really important. So we can avoid that really, really problematic history of American anthropology here in California. It is still, unfortunately, like not the norm, right? What I'm doing, what Yamamutsin is doing, what other, you know, quote unquote collaborative researchers are doing, it's still the anomaly in the field. It's not the norm. And, you know, published research has shown that like this type of science is 1% of like global archaeology. So we are literally like a drop in the bucket of the type of research. It's not easy, right? People think that, like, you know, we're doing this work and it is fulfilling, but it's like an easier pathway. But it's actually like very, very difficult to do this type of scholarship and have it recognized and valued by like your academic colleagues. So And that's what I think is like for this program, for the summer internship program for the Indigenous Archaeology Field Methods, it's showing a different way of doing archaeology. And I hope long-term that it is kind of showing this next generation that there's a different way, right? Because the counterpoint to our field school is a traditional field school. You go for 4 to 8 weeks anywhere in the world, just insert a place, that's where it's going to happen. The archaeologist will have a permit by the state or the federal government, oftentimes with like little to no like tribal collaboration. There might be consultation, right? Somebody signed off for that work to occur, and you will spend almost every single day of that field school just digging a hole. You're going to be excavating. And those archaeologists come out of that as thinking that's the reality of what like good archaeology can be. And through that, like you're contributing to like the curation issue, right? You're contributing to like this mass accumulation of Indigenous cultural heritage and museums and institutions. And oftentimes, realistically, none of that is ever really getting analyzed. It's not getting published. So we're training the next generation of archaeologists and doing archaeology like people were doing in the early 20th century, in the 1950s, in the, you know, insert a decade. I mean, that's really still the norm. So I think like through these training opportunities, through these courses, we are kind of repositioning of what priorities can be and what like archaeology can be moving forward, right? And I think that's the other like critical thing in breaking that colonial like legacy is showing a different way of doing archaeology, like wholeheartedly.
There's a lot of thresholds in place that are put in place so that if there are sensitive materials coming out of an archaeological site, we still have the ability to take a step back and be like, hey, you know what? This site is just way too sensitive and we didn't expect it to be that sensitive. Let's return everything that we dug. Let's put it right back and let's move on to another site, right? And those conversations are typically they happen in real time with tribal leadership, where we're able to like relay to them what we're actually seeing in the field. And then the ultimate decision to make an authority is in the hands of the tribal leadership. So they can decide if we shouldn't be at that site any longer. Or maybe they could make the determination, this is a really important site. We understand that this archaeological site is threatened from a development, or it's threatened by nature, you know, sea level rise or something like that, then it is okay to excavate and to sample, you know, with the basis of protecting the site and with the basis of understanding that site a little bit more. So I think at the core of tribal-led initiatives in archaeology is, number one, is methods. It's how do you approach the sampling of sites, you know, using these low impact, you know, remote sensing techniques. The second thing is the research questions. A lot of the research questions are about foodways. That could be very, very powerful and meaningful to look at the full menu, you know, and that's the one power of doing archaeology at sites. If you're taking soil samples and you're doing flotation and you're looking at like the small seeds and you're looking at the small animals, it's such a cool picture that comes out of it. And for me, that I think there's a big, it's a big turn in the road. Once you commit to doing that type of archaeology, it's so slow. It's so slow going. And that's a reason why a lot of archaeology that's done in a compliance context, they don't have the budgets to like, you know, we're going through the sand and our soil samples with tweezers, if you will, you know, under a microscope. And so that takes a long time. And so we're sacrificing this speed for doing a project with just quality of information. As archaeology students, we're taught that if you're doing work at a, you know, significant site, that that data should be curated. A mussel goes into a bag, abalone goes into another bag, these bones from a wood rat or a deer go into another bag, they all have a label, they all go in a banker box, the banker box gets labeled, goes on a shelf. It's supposed to be there for the future, right? Till someone smarter along comes on and gets to study it. But one of the big things I've learned is that, you know, sometimes tribes are asking, why do they need to go onto a shelf? You know, we've learned what we've learned from it. Why can't we rebury it, and let those materials go back to the site where they came from? From a scientific perspective, you might come back and say, well, we need to reproduce your data, right? If you're making these broad claims, there needs to be an independent person that could come in and look at your data and see if it's reproducible or not. And then what's the reality of that though? You know, there's so much data out there. There's so many archaeological sites. What is the likelihood that someone's actually going to come and revisit your data? So I think that that's an important conversation to have, and one that we're still trying to figure out. Maybe we retain certain portions of the site that was studied to retain in curation so it can be looked at in the future. And I think that's great. But the reality of it is just more of a logistic issue. You got 20 banker's boxes of sorted archaeological material and maybe soil samples. They're going to go take up space in a facility. You know, you got to take a look at that and see, is that even worth it? Is it going to be 20, 30 years by the time someone even comes around to look at that? For what? You know, the site can be, all that material can be returned to the site. There are ways that we can, you know, digitally scan a lot of these objects. There are ways that we can make the data open source so that other people can actually see the raw numbers, the raw counts, the raw weights. So these are all things that we're still thinking about, and why it's so exciting to be part of this, you know, tribal-led archaeology, if you will, because there's no one right way to do it. 2 years ago, we were out in Santa Cruz, and there was an unrecorded site. And it was right on the beach at the mouth of a creek. And the site was actively eroding into the ocean. The waves were hitting it. The creek levels were also cutting it from another side. And so, like, you went and took a look at this site, and you knew it had maybe a year to go before it was all washed away. And that's very exciting for an archaeologist, because they're kind of like, oh, holy moly, look at this site that's never been recorded. Well, you know, the potential for data, and we need to go and collect all of it, you know. And so, like, I think sometimes that's, if you look at it from a state parks perspective, if they have this site that could be eligible for either the National Register or the California Register of Historic Places, that they then have a responsibility of ethics on their side to protect and preserve this, you know, piece of history. That can involve like putting shoring up. That can involve capping it with cement and a lot of other things, right? To sort of preserve it in place in perpetuity. Like, how do we do that? And that's a kind of a common approach, right? Is to protect and preserve in place as much as possible. But it was a really interesting case because this site, you know, we knew that it wasn't going to last a year, but we were able to visit it and do a little bit of research as part of the summer intern program. And so, you know, the idea was like, let's use it for training. You know, we know that this site is a little bit less sensitive. It's what you would consider like a coastal archaeological site, a smaller one, you know, not really like a very, very large and expansive one, but a very, very small, discrete site that had developed horizons, and it was full of shellfish and fish bones and, you know, all kinds of really interesting things. And so the idea was like, let's use this as training for the Amamutsin intern so they can actually get a little bit of that archaeology training, right? It was sort of like the best of both worlds from my perspective. Is like, we have the site that is going to erode and disappear, and we got permission to study it in a very, you know, scientific way where we collected really, really good data, and everyone got a chance to actually dig. And as I mentioned earlier, you can only dig something once. It's very hard to replicate an archaeological site, and you know, and you'd really don't want to dig a site unless you have a really, really good reason to do it. And I think we did have a really good reason for training, but also to learn about the site before it disappeared forever. And so we took a fraction of it, maybe 5% of the site is what we were able to excavate and study. And then the decision was made to just let the rest wash away. And that's what's happening to that site right now. If you go out to that site, you'll see that it is almost entirely deflated. And that site, you know, all the objects and everything from that archaeological site has been reclaimed by nature. It's in the creek, it's in the ocean, it sort of has naturally distributed and flattened out throughout the area. So yeah, that's a really cool case study, and I think there might be more of that going forward. And you know, it's up to the tribes as to what their approach is and what they want to do, to leave it in place, to study it, or to let it wash away. It's all treated on a case-by-case basis.
My professor always told me, for me and all the other tribal archs, we're walking a very fine line, very, very fine line. We are walking in two worlds, and we're trying to find a way to inhabit both, trying to find a way in which we can respect and honor our ancestors and the wishes of tribal people, but as well carry out procedure and make sure that things are well documented and things are inventoried. But at the same time, you don't want it to be like that end scene in Indiana Jones, where it's just the rows and rows of boxes. And I've had had a lot of experiences doing collections work wherein I was dissatisfied with just the process of it, because it really did feel like that scene, just rows and rows of boxes. In which case, later on, I learned that some of those boxes contain human remains. And not just human remains related to my tribe and my kin. It was very, very, it's a very, very hard process to go through. And it's why other natives who I was working with at Fresno State, we all kind of had to band together and to look after one another's mental health, because it's a very draining process to try and deal with this, to rectify, like, well, we want to get these things returned. But to get these things returned, we have to participate in this system. We have to participate in the system of collections, the system of processing, the system of actually going through the boxes and seeing what's inside them. And you don't know if you're going to open up a box and find it full of like human teeth. You don't know if you're going to open up a box and see if it's full of like ancient piece of basket work from like 100 years ago, which if you're really following the old traditional ways, when basket weavers die, their baskets are supposed to go with them in their funeral or on their funeral pyre. That's the reckoning that has to happen a lot with archaeology, though, especially as a tribal archaeologist. Well, you want to get in this, you want to do this, but how much of yourself are you willing to give so you can get in there, get your foot in the door, and be in these institutions where they don't have your best interests in mind, you know, where you have to make sure that you don't lose yourself where you're doing this work. You know, that's the fine line you have to walk, and that I have had to. That's the perspective I came from.
And I do think that some of the approaches that the Amamutsin tribal band has been part of is they're exemplary of the field. And it's a really, really cool showcase of cutting edge technologies, cutting edge thinking, and where I think the future of the field is going. And so it's also just the realization of like, of looking at the actual these practices of archaeology and putting in big trenches. Again, like it's pros and cons though, right? Like if you're just doing a bunch of small probes at an archaeological site, you're really getting an incomplete picture. That trench, that old style of archaeology, it is really informative, right? Because you're like, you're cutting into a cake. Well, we can learn about a site without even digging it. Or if we decide to dig, we could do it very carefully and, you know, use that medical analogy, right? Like using geophysics at an archaeological site is like doing an MRI or a CAT scan, right? It's non-invasive. We get to map in and image the subsurface. And then you can employ something like an auger, which is a very small diameter bucket. It's this thing that you take a vertical sample of the soil. Think of that as like a biopsy, you know? You're not cutting yourself open, you're doing just a little probe, and you're really just trying to take a look at what's going on under there. And then you could think of like a good old-fashioned excavation archaeological site as like invasive surgery, you know, where you're cutting the site open and you're really trying to expose some area.
We were at a site near Año Nuevo Beach, and I never got to see the site in its prime because the crew who did the excavations and the studies on it, that was last year's crew. And I came on for this year. So all I knew about the site near Año Nuevo Beach was that it was an earthen oven and that they had looked at it and analyzed it last year. And they basically concluded that the site that they were studying was more or less falling off into the ocean, and it would be swallowed up eventually. And for most arcs, they'd be like, well, we need to document this, and we need to freaking empty the whole thing out and just, you know, get everything put into boxes from that and ship it to like some storage facility down the road and this and that. But the land trust and the tribe, they had a different approach. And that approach was for the site at Año Nuevo, for this earthen oven and for all the arch surrounding it, they decided, you know what? If this site is going to fall off into the ocean, it's going to be swallowed up, you know, by the eroding waters. Maybe we should just let it go, you know. And that's a hard proposition. And that's a real hard proposition for some people. But that is kind of traditional to what we do as Native people. You know, we have a belief, you know, it's a very widespread belief that things have a beginning and eventually they have their end. And you need to respect that. You need to respect when something's end comes and you need to let it go in a good way. And for this site, you know, it was a couple hundred years old. It had been pretty battered, partially looted a little bit, possibly, you know. And they did, at the very end of its life, get to study it and record it. And the proof will always be there that it existed. But at the very end, they decided to let it go. And so when we arrived this year, I was like, well, where's the oven? I saw the pictures. Where is it? And they're like, Cameron, that's it. It's right there. And it's just all washed out. They're like, dang. It was just a good chunk of it would have been floated down into the ocean, you know. It was a cool spot still, though. There was tons of, like, Año Nuevo shirt. You know, you can still find flakes here and there stuff, and well, it was a pretty good source of it. But for all intents and purposes, that site was, you know, 3/4 gone almost. And, you know, there's a bittersweet feeling to that. You know, the bitterness being that, like, oh, well, it's gone. We can never, you know, future generations won't see it. But the somewhat sweeter feeling to it is, well, you know, we recorded it, we know of it. And now it's been put to rest, you know. Sometimes, you know, that is an option. Instead of trying to preserve things for millennia forward, you know, freaking trying to keep these things in little, put them on pedestals behind glass cases forever and forever. Sometimes, depending on what is called for, what seems appropriate, sometimes these things just need to be put to rest. And that's a very, very different perspective that AMLT and AMTB, the tribal band, has versus other archaeological firms. You know, I feel like there's a lot of people at the Society for California Archaeology who would like clutch their pearls. They're like, you just let a site fall off into the ocean? You didn't put up like a barrier to protect it and to keep it? No, just let it be. You know, sometimes you just gotta let it be. Nothing you really can do, especially in this age of climate change.
When I first met Gabriel, I'm a shy and reserved person. but I feel like he's really welcoming and he's very opening and he's always making jokes. So it feels easy to like laugh and also like just be able to open up yourself. So I definitely feel I always have that feeling working with him, and I'm always having fun. And when I'm see him again, he's like an uncle. He feels like my uncle sometimes. But he's always caring for us, and he's always like, even off the work site, he's like maybe giving us advice or he's always checking in. I think it's important because he has been working there so long, and you can see it. You can see he just works so like effortlessly and efficiently, and it's without even thinking about it. It's him just doing it because it's part of his nature at this point. So seeing it, and I think it's very noticeable from even the youth because they see him and he's been working there so long. He's a role model for this work. You know, he's. I would say he's a pillar to it because he's been doing it for so long.
There's so much that I still need to learn. You know, there's always more learning and taking in information from this person there, or a book, or and also learning from our elders like Val. And also, I wouldn't be able to learn this if it wasn't, you know, teaching me like Gabe Sanchez, Mike Grohn, Alec, and, you know, Rob Cutthroat, Kent Lightfoot. And, you know, they've been a big part of why I know this knowledge.
Got the doctor, got the call from the Pinnacles National Park crew, said, hey, this young Chalon guy, he's going to be graduating pretty soon with his bachelor's in archaeology. You need someone to do archaeology. And Alec, he was like, oh, yeah, we'll call him up. And they got in contact with me. And I was like, yes, I want to join. I was like, I've been trying, my family and tribe have been trying to get connected with the land trust, with the Yamawutsin for like the last 5 years, but COVID ruined everything. So I got on with the internship, and it was just, it was very intimidating just because you don't really know what to expect. You're always worried someone's going to try to like out native you, out like, you know, have their chests all pumped up. You don't know how they're going to be real cool or like, oh, well, you're not really native. You know, I've met people who are like that, you know, and it's not cool when they do that. But the whole crew was amazing. You know, they're like all my, they might as well have just been my cousins out there. You know, I connected with them so quickly and worked out there between Santa Cruz County and San Benito County for 5 weeks. And it was a good 5 weeks.
Yeah, I definitely think it's amazing because a lot of our interns are on the younger side. They're, we have 17-year-olds all the way up to to Gabriel Pineda, you know, his age. So, and most of us are in our 20s and we're either around the same age as them or like a little bit younger, and we're teaching them. And it's wonderful because we're gaining that experience on the field, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you need experience in academia. You know, you're able to pick it up. You just need to be able to understand. It's not something that is only a certain amount of people can do. Anyone can do it.
This summer, we also had the honor of working at Urusok, right? Myself, physically, I wouldn't be able to access that space, and I probably shouldn't, right, without having kind of tribal involvement. And we had the opportunity to do survey in areas that were really, really important to the tribe, that there's tribal knowledge of these spaces. And again, it's something that was supporting tribal goals and kind of entering this very, very important like cultural space, right? So it's and there's countless examples over the 4 weeks of, you know, Pinnacles National Park with Cam and his family, and, you know, bringing tribes together who haven't been together in that space for over 200 years, right? And again, I really feel, and maybe administrators here at the university might want to hear, not hear this, but that like the archaeology is really secondary to what we're doing in this program, right?
Honestly, those are also my favorite parts, working with different tribes and just meeting different relatives from different tribes. Especially with last year working with Esalen, we worked there for a whole week, I believe, with Esalen. I felt like that was my favorite part from last year, because we're able to learn from them and just hearing them too. It's just a different connection because we're connecting to different tribal people and we have similar experiences. And also just be able to work there and like we're just like building relationships together. And also this year with Canyon, we're able to meet her and Anne-Marie Sayers and be able to just talk with her and chat with her. I think I hold that to dear too because I'm with an elder and I'm learning. And I know that she also has so much experience, you know, with Indian Canyon, and be able to see that Indian Canyon for the first time. It was very beautiful. And having Canyon also come out to eat dinner with us and just hearing from them too. We're playing hand games. I think just building relationships with them and hopefully being able to see them more next year. Also with Pinnacles, seeing Cameron, he was so happy because that's his place, right? That's his tribal area. Meeting his family and being able to know more about them and also hearing their stories and their history. They were able to give us a little like presentation. They spoke with us and I just love learning. So being able to learn from them, and seeing, because them too, they're coming from different places too. they're coming from far away. And I think that's one thing that we can all connect on, is that we all come from not from our lands, like we're born elsewhere. So be able to come back and work there, we all have this mutual understanding that we're taking it serious, and it's meaningful because, again, you're not able to go out there every single day.
We were all sharing our personal histories throughout the days at camp. You learn a lot about people sleeping in a tent next to them for 5 weeks. You know, you learn a lot about people very quickly, you know, about their personality, about their character, about their work ethic. You know, very quickly, I went from being a new guy on the block to almost like a long lost cousin. And I would tell them about my history and my knowledge of, you know, Chulon. They told me about their knowledge and history of Motsin and stuff with the tribal band and what it's been like. And my role tended to be de facto. I would like report to Alec and I'd ask him, like, hey, what do we got to do? What's on board for today? What's we're going to be doing this current week? And he's like, okay, we're going to need this. We're going to need that. We're going to need pocket scales. We're going to need this paperwork, that paperwork. He's like, can you get that prepped? And I'm like, sure. So I'd be spending some of my evenings off just prepping gear, like boxes of the gear. So I'm getting it ready for the interns and the university Oregon students to use.
My actual title was a senior cultural technician. So last year I was with the summer internship. So I learned, that was like my first time learning about archaeology. But even throughout, when I was a teenager, I remember doing a little bit of mapping, I think, on a brand that was called Tremble. So relearning it, but on a different one called Emlid, it felt more natural. It was easy to pick up on. So this time around, I was on Emlid and I was helping teach on how to map. And not just like our stewards and our interns, but also helping teach the Oregon students on how to map. A lot of us are living mostly in the valley. There's some of us that probably live around Hollister, Watsonville. I know some of us live in like Scotts Valley. But during the school year, you know, we're all busy. We all have jobs, like we have lives. And it's hard to get together, especially like interweaving that with our own personal lives. So during the summer, when usually most people have breaks from school or just have, maybe they're working a teacher job and they can join during the summer, it's mostly our time to be together. And usually it lasts for about like 5 weeks. And we're actually like, we're living together, we're eating together, we're waking up together, we're doing a whole daily routine together. So it's really bonding us. And you're with your family 24 hours a day, and you're going to be, you know, maybe arguing with them a little bit, bickering, but it's a part of it. And that's what part of family is. So you really, you're learning about each other more and you're trusting each other. And that also shows on our work because we know how to work together because we're living together. I think it's important for us because that was our only time to see each other. And when we see each other, it's, we go all in.
For all intents and purposes, on paper, I was just another intern. But internally wise, I was somewhat a supervisor, you know. As the weeks went on, my supervisor roles kind of got more intensified until eventually, once we got to Pinnacles and we were out there for the whole week, like I was given a whole lot of authority because I've studied Pinnacles for a while now. It's always been my dream to do archaeology in Pinnacles. Like ever since I got into university and doing anthropology studies, I've wanted to do archaeology at Pinnacles. I'm like, I want to write my thesis on this if I can, you know, if I can help it. So when I first got brought on for the internship, I was, you know, new guy on the block, you know, new face. None of the crew didn't know me, and I didn't know any of the crew. As the weeks went on, I got more familiar with people. One of the interns, I think it was Eric, who said this to Elizabeth. When he first met me, he told Elizabeth, oh, have you met Cameron yet? It's hella Nader. I didn't learn that until later. It went from me being in that position where I'm like the new guy on the block, and I'm getting familiar with everybody, to we're all toiling together. We're sharing each other's histories. I would say everything kind of coalesced around week five in Pinnacles. That first day, we had representatives from, obviously, the Amotsin, from my tribe and from the Salinans. We were trying to get the Esalens in as well, but they were very busy with things, and they were working on a couple projects, so they weren't able to make it, but they sent their love. It was a really beautiful moment because for all of us, Pinnacles, it means something to all of us. That is a very, very sacred site. As Chairman Little Bear said, he's like, oh, we're from our tribal property, that which they recently acquired. He's like, we can see straight towards Pinnacle. We can see you guys from up on the mountain. And I was like, that's crazy. And you can only imagine, like, there aren't too many geographic markers back in the pre-contact times. So Chairman Little Bear, at one point during fire camp, he had described Pinnacles as being part of the gate, which leads from, starts way, way back in the east, and then leads from the east to the west. And Pinnacles is part of the gate, with Ventana Wilderness area, you know, the Ventana, the window being the final gate to the afterlife, you know, because we believe the afterlife, heaven and such, is in the ocean. So there's a lot of like beliefs surrounding Pinnacles. Obviously in the Mutsun language, Pinnacles is referred to as Biknachi, Knachi. The name for it in Shalom did not survive, was not passed down or recorded. More in the Spanish language, was the Spaniards always referred to Pinnacles during the mission era as Sierra del Chalón, because they knew that if they went up there, they could always find Chalons to bring down to the mission and convert. So that's why they always referred to Pinnacles as Sierra del Chalón, because our village was on the eastern side of Pinnacles. Not necessarily because, you know, we have full ownership to it. We don't subscribe to the idea that, you know, we own Pinnacles. Only one group can own Pinnacles. No. Pinnacles, like any other sacred spot, any other sacred site, is someplace that's shared. You don't hoard your medicine. You don't hoard these sacred sites. You want to come into ceremony with all your community, with all these people you have good relations with, and you want to make peace with. That was what was kind of a center point of that first day at Pinnacles. We had all these representatives from like these three tribes. You know, when was the last time we had like a sort of little sit down like that, you know, a little mini ceremony where all these folks are meeting together, and then we're going to go march up into the site we're going to be working, which is McCabe Canyon. We're going to learn about these new upcoming methods that the Land Trust is doing. We're going to exchange ideas. We're going to exchange knowledge. You know, how often does that happen? And it was a beautiful moment. We all exchanged gifts. My relatives, my cousin, Larry, he came up all the way from Bakersfield. My cousin Paulette, she flew in from Oklahoma. That's where part of our family lives. And then my cousin Christine, she drove all the way down from British Columbia, Canada. That's where she and her family live out at. So they're coming. We have Chalons coming from all different directions. And you know, we're sharing words with Val. We're sharing words with Shawnee, and she brought along Mary Rogers and her daughter Jessica. And one of their other cousins, and all these really cool folks, and obviously all the people from the Amlitsin. It was really a beautiful moment. In recent history, there hasn't always been the best effort to try and work towards tribal unity, tribal cooperation, inter-tribal work. You know, every single band and org here on the Central Coast kind of does their own thing most of the time. But now we're entering this era where all these young ones are coming up and these new ideas are coming in, and everyone, like, we all want to work towards working closer together. I've even heard talk about an intertribal Native Stewardship Corps. You know, wouldn't that be something? And I'm hoping that maybe that one day in Pinnacles, that'll be part of the seeds which are spread to have that idea grow out from there.
I think that's what really makes it collaborative, is that, you know, it's not being driven by me or my research questions or my agenda. It's really that myself, my graduate students, and, you know, the students participating are supporting tribal goals and initiatives, and we're coming out to add archaeological capacity, but also to recognize that that capacity is within the tribe themselves. And it's kind of that mutual dialogue in the program, because the archaeology without the culture is almost meaningless.
I'm very fortunate to learn what good archaeology looks like, and it's through my tribe, especially with the history of anthropology and archaeology. It's not the best. It's not good. And how, that's what made me get into anthropology, because I know what good archaeology looks like. And I know it can be done. It's doable. I feel like my highlight overall is the way I feel out there with my family. I feel like when we're together as a group, it feels very powerful. And when we're out there on our sacred lands, where the lands hold their own power, like it's just, it gives me a deep sense of unity and strength and peacefulness to be able to see all that and be there together. It definitely feels one in a lifetime, but now I know that it's not, because we're slowly getting back to our lands. And I think that just, it fills me with overwhelming feelings of joy and just happiness, knowing that we're all together and healing. It's part of our healing journey.
It's just the right thing to do, Martin. When you think about it, it's their cultural heritage. So what better way to protect heritage at a broad scale, but also understand it, to actually have the people who own the heritage as part of the process from the very beginning to the very end? I just think it's the right thing to do, and it makes archaeology better for that very reason. And I think it's something that's been sorely missed in the field, is to have indigenous people involved in the process of archaeology.
I'm gonna tell you, for me, if doing this is very rewarding to me, because I've had a hard life. I've dealt with addiction and stuff like that. Next month I'll be 10 years of sobriety, and if we didn't have this program, I wouldn't know where I would be at today, you know. And this really saved my life. I started finding myself through this program as who I am as a person, and not wanting to be an addict and wanting to actually live my life as a sober Native American and walk the path of my ancestors, and to learn different plants or different things that they're teaching me here in this program, so I can teach my grandkids or my kids and just pass it on to the community. It feels great to like teach my young cousins and family members, and even elders, because elders don't really know and can't really get out here. It's like telling them my story out here, you know, like what we're doing, getting praise from them, and, you know, that they're proud of us. And, you know, that feels very good, you know, inside as a Native person, and also being in the community, you know, that feels good. This is something that I love to do, and I wish I could do it my whole life. But when we get older, you know, there's a time where we got to stop.
The tribal members have really excelled in every way, shape, or form. They're really our top performers in this field school. And I think, you know, there's more skin in the game, right? There's more investment, right? Like, they're not studying something abstract or separate from them. Like, this is their heritage. These are their ancestors. These are these cultural landscapes that are really key to the tribe today, not some, you know, thought about past. And it's been really spectacular to see kind of the growth and just professionalization in some aspects for a lot of tribal members who are excelling in this field, but also they're archaeologists themselves, right? They're archaeologists, they're arborists, they're fire ecologists, you know, they're all the ologies you could think of from an academic perspective, but tribal members are excelling in that capacity in every way, shape, or form. It's been really spectacular to see.
The internship is about to learn about our culture. We're able to go out there and learn about it through the land and being on the land.
Working towards these things is going to be instrumental, especially within the coming decade, because one of the things I think about a lot is how much tribal-led archaeology, tribal-led survey and stewardship, how important these things are going to be in the coming decades, in the coming generations.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Challenging Colonialism. In this episode, you heard from Gabriel Pineda, Elizabeth Rodriguez, Cameron Dakota Chow Garcia, Gabe Sanchez, and Alec Apodaca. Challenging Colonialism is produced by myself, Martin Rizzo Martinez, and by Daniel Stoneblum. All interviews were done by myself, all audio engineering and editing by Daniel, all music by G. Gonzalez, with logo art and animation by Professor John Jota Leaños. please subscribe, follow, rate, and review the podcast on whatever platform you use. And as always, thank you for listening.